I'm Dick Meyer. This is Decode DC. We often say that books we really like are thought-provoking. Every few years, if we're lucky, we might stumble on one that is positively thought-exploding. That just happened to me. The book is called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind.
And for me, it's a basic question, how does power get translated into happiness or suffering? Humankind has an amazing ability to acquire power, but we seem to be much less capable when it comes to translating power into happiness.
It's history like you've never read it before, with doses of biology, psychology, and anthropology. This week, we'll talk to the audacious and certifiably brilliant Yuval Noah Harari about history, Homo sapiens, and the meaning of life.
For me, religion is about answers, and spirituality is about questions. The spiritual quest is when you ask a big question, like, who am I, or what is reality? And you're willing to follow this question wherever it takes you.
I'm going to do what I think is a big favor for you in this podcast, and you can thank me later. I'm going to introduce you to Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. I'm going to abandon journalistic detachment for just a moment to say that this is the most stimulating work of nonfiction I have read in years. Sapiens was published in Hebrew in 2011. It's been translated into 26 languages, and now it's out in English. It's a bestseller in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Harari is a historian at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, but he doesn't fit into the usual academic boxes. The very idea of writing a history of the species is itself an audacious and even grandiose notion, especially when the author is still in his 30s. The genius of this book is in the questions it asks.
Two very important things is that this book tries to give the entire picture of history from the very beginning up until the 21st century and actually going even into the future, trying to see what are the possibilities ahead of us. And in doing so, the book combines insights from biology with insights from history and from the humanities. My basic understanding is that you can't really do history without biology, but biology isn't enough. It's just the basis. And so you have to combine the two. And secondly, it was very important for me to try and understand not only what happened in history, but also its deeper meaning, especially in terms of the lives of individuals. So throughout the book, one of the main questions was not only what happened, but did it make people more miserable, happier? How did it influence the daily life of the average individual?
Which is something that comes through enormously in the book. People have written about evolution, progress, the basics of human history for a long time, but you seem to ask questions like, was the agricultural revolution good or bad for us as a species? Is progress good? You ask these questions in a way that is strikingly new.
Yes, I think what is really new is the attempt to ask questions about happiness and suffering. Usually when we describe history, we focus on questions of power. How our species gained power, how particular kingdoms and empires and collectives gained power, and how particular individuals like Genghis Khan or Hitler gained power. So most of history, in most history books, revolves around questions of power. And power is, of course, very important, but there is another side to the story, and this is the side of happiness and suffering. And for me, the basic question is, how does power get translated into happiness or suffering? Humankind has an amazing ability to acquire power, but we seem to be much less capable when it comes to translating power into happiness. And again, you see throughout history this phenomenon that humankind is becoming far more powerful than before, but people are not becoming happier, and the world is not becoming a better place. And this for me was maybe the most interesting and most important thing about history, is to understand this relation, this complex relation between power and happiness.
Why is it this vicious cycle of progress versus happiness?
Well, there are three main mechanisms that scholars have identified. First of all, happiness does not really depend on objective conditions. Happiness depends far more on expectations. We are happy not when things are good, but when our expectations are fulfilled. And the problem with progress is that when conditions improve, expectations also increase. There is, for instance, the example of the Arab Spring and the revolution in Egypt in 2011.
Mubarak resigns. Tahrir Square responds.
About an hour after the news is announced across the square, that wall of sound is still there, barely diminished.
If you think in objective terms about the living conditions of the average Egyptian, things were never so good as under Hosni Mubarak. Nevertheless, as we all know, Egyptians were not terribly happy with the Mubarak regime. They made a revolution and toppled him, and now they are probably disappointed with the results of that as well. A second mechanism is on the biological level. What really determines human happiness or misery is not events in the outside world, but it is the condition of our biochemical system within our body. We still have basically the same biochemistry as in the Middle Ages or in the ancient world. And because what determines our happiness or misery is the biochemistry, not the economy, not politics, so things haven't really changed. Despite all the enormous historical and technological progress of humankind. And the third major explanation, perhaps the deepest explanation, is that the most basic reaction of the human mind to pleasure and to achievement is not satisfaction, but rather it is craving for more. Even when people experience something very pleasant, even when they have some big achievement, the reaction is not to be satisfied, but to be afraid that they will lose what they have, or to crave to have even more.
Let me tell you something. There is no nobility in poverty. I have been a rich man and I have been a poor man, and I choose rich every time. Because at least as a rich man, when I have to face my problems, I show up in the back of a limo wearing a $2,000 suit and a $40,000 gold f***ing watch.
And because this is the most basic pattern of the human mind, no matter what humans have achieved throughout history, they are never satisfied. They simply crave for more. And this is what has been pushing history forward in the economic, in the technological field, in the political field. This is why we have acquired so much power, but we haven't become more satisfied than we were thousands of years ago.
Harari readily admits that trying to answer questions about how happy or content humans were in the distant past is speculative, but he says there are some good clues and scientific foundations. A good example of that comes from the agricultural revolution that occurred about 12,000 years ago.
When it comes to the agricultural revolution, we have quite a lot of evidence which is relevant to these issues of happiness and suffering. For instance, we know, and this we know from a lot of archaeological and anthropological evidence, that people suffered far more from disease after the agricultural revolution than before, because most infectious diseases that plague humankind actually come from domesticated animals, like cattle and sheep and pigs. Even today,
More than 700 people have now died of swine flu across India since January. Most of them...
The bird flu has struck a second egg farm in Iowa. About 5.3 million laying hens will be destroyed after tests confirmed the outbreak. The
USDA... Almost every year, we hear about an epidemic of avian flu coming from domesticated chickens, or an epidemic of swine flu coming from domesticated pigs. Prior to the agricultural revolution, hunter-gatherers subsisted by eating dozens of different species of animals and plants and mushrooms and berries and nuts and so forth. So they got a very rich and balanced diet with all the nutrients and minerals and vitamins they needed. In contrast, most peasants, for much of history, subsisted on a single staple crop like wheat in the Middle East or potatoes in South America or rice in East Asia. Their diet was much poorer, far less balanced, with far fewer minerals and vitamins and so forth. So they had a worse diet. And in addition to all these problems, they suffered far more from social hierarchies and social exploitation. In small hunter-gatherer tribes, there was very little room for social hierarchies and exploitation. But once you have the agricultural revolution, you witness the rise of cities and kingdoms and empires and very big gaps between a very small elite that monopolizes most of the wealth and the vast majority of the population. If we adopt the viewpoint of a Chinese peasant in the Middle Ages, or even of working class people today in the world, suddenly the agricultural revolution seems like a far worse idea. There are hundreds of millions of people today in the world that live much harder lives than their ancestors tens of thousands of years ago.
Whoa, I need a breather after that. So more topsy-turvy history with Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, after a break.
Decode DC is sponsored by Igloo. Here's the thing. You don't have to hate your business's intranet. Igloo is better, easy to use, easy to configure, and all on a cloud platform so you and your team can do your best work. Share files, blog updates, coordinate calendars, and manage projects. Igloo looks great and works great on your computer screen or on your phone. Whether you're a large enterprise stuck using SharePoint or a fast-growing business overwhelmed by apps, create an intranet that matches your brand's look and feel, simplifies how you work, and is accessible on your phone. Sign up now and try it for free at igloosoftware.com/decode. That's igloosoftware.com/decode. Decode DC is also sponsored by High Five. How many times have you had a meeting where you waste the first 15 minutes? It's usually because somebody has trouble joining the call, or you can't share your screen, or someone else can't be heard, or they don't have the right PIN code. Nothing but problems. Well, the people at High Five want to give you back the first 15 minutes of every meeting. That's why they built easy-to-use video and web conferencing that you will actually love. High Five is a seamlessly integrated hardware and cloud software solution that lets people work however they want. Enjoy productive meetings in HD video with multiple people. Instantly start an HD video meeting from your computer or mobile device. There's no remote to lose or to struggle to understand how to use. High Five is only 1/20th the cost of traditional video providers. Outfit a conference room for only $799, and that's a one-time fee. There's no maintenance fees or monthly overhead. It's yours to enjoy. What team doesn't want to high-five each other at work? Get started today and take back those first 15 minutes of every meeting. Go to highfive.com/decode for a free trial of High Five. That's HIGHFIVE.com/decode. Request your free trial and start meeting face-to-face with High Five.
We're back with Decode DC. I'm Dick Meyer, talking to the Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari about his book, humbly titled Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. Other species, Harari says, can only live together and cooperate in fairly small groups, but Homo sapiens eventually came to cooperate on a massive scale, in large groups. Harari has a theory about how this came to be.
If you examine every large-scale human cooperation, what you find at its basis is fiction. It's imaginary stories. We can cooperate with strangers because we invent fictional stories and share them around. And as long as everybody believes in the same mythology, in the same stories, everybody can cooperate effectively, can follow the same laws, the same norms. In chimpanzees, you cannot do such a thing. You can never, for example, convince a chimpanzee to give you a banana by promising him that after he dies, he will go to chimpanzee heaven and there receive lots and lots of bananas for his good deeds. No chimpanzee will ever believe such a story. This is why chimpanzees cannot cooperate in large numbers to build cathedrals or to build synagogues or to go on crusades and jihads and so forth. But this is true not only in the religious field, it's also true in the political field, in the legal field, in the economic field. For example, in the legal field, perhaps the most important idea in the legal world today is the idea of human rights. Our entire political and legal system is based on this belief in human rights. But human rights are just like God and heaven. It is also a fiction, a story that humans have invented over the last few centuries. Most humans in history didn't know anything about the existence of such a thing, human rights. It's not a biological reality. It's not written in our DNA that we have rights. If you cut open a human, you don't find any rights inside. The only place that human rights exist is in the stories that we have begun to invent and to spread around over the last few centuries. And today, billions of people believe in this story, and this is why we can create these sophisticated networks of legal and political cooperation. Now, I don't mean to say that human rights are bad. They are very good. Fiction is an extremely important, perhaps the most important creation of humankind. Without believing in some fiction or the other, be it God or human rights, you simply cannot construct a functioning human society. You find the same thing happening in the economic field. Maybe the most successful story ever told by humans is the story of money. If you take a dollar bill, it has no objective value. It has no biological or physical value. You cannot eat it. You cannot drink it. You cannot do anything with it. But then you tell a story about these pieces of paper. You have very important people like the president, like the chairman of the Federal Reserve, like all the finance ministers. Tell us a story that this green piece of paper is actually worth 10 bananas. And as long as everybody believes in this story, it works. It enables me to go to a distant city, which I've never visited before, to approach a stranger whom I have never met before in a supermarket, give him this worthless piece of paper, and in exchange, get real bananas that I can actually eat.
So does it follow that individual happiness and contentment is very directly tied then to the effectiveness of our fictions, to the efficacy of our stories and our beliefs?
To some extent, yes. The power of a society often depends on the stability of its fictions, of its stories. And when people lose faith in the basic stories of their society, then society tends to collapse. But on the other hand, there is also an opposite phenomenon. When people develop so much faith in their stories and give them so much importance that instead of the stories working for us, we begin to work for the stories. So there is a complex relation here. On the one hand, we need the stories. Without them, without believing in them, in at least some stories, we cannot create a functioning societies. On the other hand, when we forget that these are just stories that we have invented. We are enslaved by them, and very often we will cause tremendous amount of suffering to ourselves and to other humans and to other animals for the sake of these fictions.
I asked Harari about the future of our stories, especially the religious ones.
What we are seeing now in the world is that some stories are becoming less important, less powerful. For example, the stories of the traditional religions. But you see the rise of new and very, very powerful stories. You see, for example, the rise of a new wave of techno-religions coming from places like Silicon Valley. Techno-religions are religions that make all the old promises. They also promise you eternal life and health and happiness and justice. However, not after you die with the help of some god, but here on Earth with the help of technology. If you now go to Silicon Valley, you will hear a lot of prophets that promise you that if we'll just have the right technology, people can live forever happy in just societies here on Earth. My hunch is that these are going to be the dominant religions, the dominant mythologies of the 21st century. They will not necessarily really make people happier, but they have what it takes to conquer the world, to carry hundreds of millions of people in the wake. My belief is that in order to really make people happy, in order to make the world a happier place, a better place, the important thing is not to create the best fiction, but rather to be able to differentiate very clearly between fiction and reality. For me, perhaps the best test to distinguish reality from fiction is the test of suffering. If you want to know whether something is real, just ask yourself, can it suffer? When a nation loses a war, it doesn't suffer. We say that the nation suffered a defeat, like Germany suffered a defeat in the First World War. But this is just a metaphor. Germany is just a story in the minds of people. It cannot really suffer. The most powerful things in the world today are mostly fictional entities, but people don't realize it. The most powerful things in the world today are things like nations, like corporations, like, I don't know, Microsoft, Google, the World Bank, the United States, China. These are all stories that we have invented, but now they are so powerful that the very survival of humans and other animals today depends on the wishes and decisions of these fictional entities.
What about on an individual level? I found myself careening as I read the book from the jubilation of exciting new ideas to despair at the futility of human existence and the idea that looking for the meaning of life is a project based on a bunch of old inherited fictions.
I've always been very interested in the meaning of life. Very often when we ask the big questions about life, who am I? What am I doing here? What is it all about? What we get as a reply, as an answer, is some fictional story that people have invented 200 years ago or 2000 years ago. It can be a story about God and heaven, or it can be a story about human rights. Now, I'm not against religion, and I'm not against human rights. I think that they have done a lot of good to the world, and it would have been very difficult to construct functioning human societies without them. But when you ask the big questions, they get in your way. They don't allow you to actually see reality. Even worse, they give you the impression that there is an answer, and you stop asking the questions. I make a distinction between religion and spirituality. I think I'm not a religious person, but I am a very spiritual person. For me, religion is about answers, and spirituality is about questions. The spiritual quest is when you ask a big question, like, who am I, or what is reality? And you're willing to follow this question wherever it takes you. And on the way, to question the most fundamental beliefs and institutions of your society. This is spirituality, or the spiritual quest. Religion, on the other hand, is about answers. It gives you a story and it says, this is the answer. This is what humans are. This is the meaning of life. This is what the universe is all about, and that's it. And once you accept this answer, the story ends. You don't go on. So for me, the history is very important because it shows you the roots of all these common stories. When you study the history of human rights, or when you study the history of Judaism and Christianity, then you realize that, wait, these are only stories that humans have invented, and they have changed a lot over the centuries. They might be very helpful in many respects, but if I really want to go deep and to follow the big question, I have to put these stories aside.
Unfortunately for us, Harari says individual Homo sapiens have not gotten more intelligent over time.
As a species, we know far more, of course, than 10 or 20,000 years ago. But as individuals, I suspect that we actually know less. 20,000 years ago, in order to survive, you needed to know so many things about the world. You needed to know how to get your own food, how to prepare your own clothes, your own tools, how to heal yourself if you became sick. Today, in contrast, humankind as a collective, of course, knows far more. But on the individual level, we are actually far less capable than our ancestors because we rely on the economic and social network around us to provide us with 99% of what we need. And there is, in fact, evidence from the size of fossilized skulls that the size of the human brain has been shrinking over the last 10,000 years since the agricultural revolution.
Many people feel that that process is being accelerated because of computers and modern technology, where we can increasingly rely on machines and technology to do so many things that we used to do independently with our own cognition even a few years ago. In some of your writings about modern technology in computers, I get the sense that you worry that the current technological revolution could be like the agricultural revolution millennia ago, in that it degrades our lives and our happiness and our contentment as individuals.
Yes, I think that there are causes for worry, and there are two things that I think we can point out. First of all, we are losing touch with the reality of here and now, of the present moment, of our own bodies, of our own sensations. People are becoming more and more distracted in the computer, in their cell phones, in their tablets, and so forth. Our ability to actually pay attention to what is happening here and now, to what is happening within my body, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, these abilities are being eroded. So again, we are becoming more powerful, but we are less able to be focused, to pay attention, to live in the present, and you cannot be happy except in the present moment. So this is one source for concern. The other source for concern is in a far larger scale, that there is a distinct danger that humans, or at least most humans, will become useless, as computers and computer algorithms will be able to outperform humans in most tasks. What we are witnessing is the potential of intelligence and consciousness being decoupled, separated from one another. If you think about a taxi driver, if you have a super intelligent computer that can drive you from point A to point B, but it's not conscious, it doesn't matter. So it will be very easy and very attractive to replace all the human taxi drivers with computer algorithms. And the same thing will happen in more and more fields. And the danger is that humans will simply become useless. And I think that the biggest question in economics and in politics of the 21st century is, what will we do with all these useless people? And it will be a big irony that this technology that humans have created to make themselves more powerful will actually make humans completely useless.
There's a sobering thought to end with: humans made useless by artificial intelligence. Don't think of that as a prediction, but as a question to think about as you fall deeper and deeper into the grip of your devices and your technology. Like a brilliant, guileless teenager, Harari asks the biggest questions about history. Sapiens is written as a story in clear, funny, assertive language with few footnotes and academic citations. If you don't like having the fictions you believe in challenged, stay away. If you do, get a copy of Sapiens.
This episode is sponsored by High Five. Go to highfive.com/decode and get a free trial of High Five. That's HIGHFIVE.com/decode to request your free trial and start meeting face to face with High Five.
Decode DC is a production of Scripps News, coming to you from the Scripps Washington Bureau. This episode was produced by Dan Bloom. Liz Sheltons is our data reporter. Decode DC reporter is Miranda Green. Mark George is our digital producer. Our editor and the director of digital content is Phil Pruitt. Scripps' Washington Bureau chief is Ellen Weiss. And special thanks this week to Ilona Arial and Itzhak Yahav, as well as Tina, Catherine, and Amanda at HarperCollins. We'd also like to thank Ryan and Ben Martinez and Austin Mattert for their original music in this piece. Andrea Seabrook will be back next week. For Decode DC, this is Dick Meyer.